May the peace of our Lord Jesus be present with us this evening as we consider more of the Dutch-Russian story. I was reminded last night that I was assuming too much. I talked to you about the cages that were hanging on St. Lambert's Church, and I was encouraged to tell why that happened. It's the first skeleton in the closet. So I just alluded to the first skeleton last night, and the request is I tell more of that. And I'm also reminding you that tomorrow night I talk about the second skeleton in the closet. It is even much worse than the first skeleton. Okay. What happened? Let me put this on an overhead so you can think about it while I tell the story. Probably ought to have the cordless mic because I'm going to be spending a lot of time down there. I forgot to get it earlier. That's my problem. Okay, why did they put Anabaptists in those cages? Well, here's the story. There was a man by the name of Melchior Hoffman who was a Lutheran who became an Anabaptist, and he went north in his work, but he was also kind of an apocalyptic sort of person. He liked to read Daniel and Revelation and involve himself in prophecies. Well, one time an old man prophesied that he was going to be put in prison for a half a year at Strasbourg. So, at the appropriate time, the 144,000 were supposed to be gathering to Strasbourg. I think he thought this is where the Christ kingdom was going to be set up on earth. And so, in cooperation with this vision, he just went up to Strasbourg and he got promptly arrested, which is fulfillment of the prophecy. Got put in prison, just like the prophecy said, except that at the end of 6 months, the authorities were no way ready to let him out. So he stayed there for the rest of 10 years until he died. Okay, one of his influence in the North affected a number of different people, and it was basically peaceful. But this man, John Matthies, had a different version of this whole thing. Remember, this is apocalyptic times, and rebaptism is a part of what Anabaptism is. And it's like you had to be baptized. You had to have the mark of Christ in your forehead if you want to be a part of this new kingdom that's just about ready to be established. Well, it turns out that the new kingdom is going to be established at Munster instead of over at Strasbourg. And so they sent out missionaries to gather people who need to be baptized and come to Munster to be a part of the kingdom that Christ is going to be setting up soon. So these people went out and evangelized, and when people came in here, they got rebaptized. And with this rebaptism, though, it was on top of a previous believer's baptism. It's like a sign of a blood covenant that they're ready to get into the new order of things. And part of the new order of things is, since the kingdom of Christ is going to be set up here, we're going to have to take the sword and we're going to make it happen. And wow, that was a desperate kind of move. And, well, the authorities around the area thought, too, this is pretty desperate. So the bishop, who was a Catholic, got an army, put it right around, and laid siege to Munster. And the Protestants, believe it or not, also helped with this army. The Anabaptists were on the loose, and we need to deal with them. And so they surrounded, and Munster was under siege. Well, John Matthies, I don't know if he got some kind of vision or somebody convinced him, he decided he's going to take a few of his men and they're going to go out and they're going to fight this surrounding army, and the Lord's going to give them a tremendous breakthrough. Well, he went out with his little sortie and he was promptly killed. And so another man took over by the name of John of Leiden. And now the siege is getting worse. And by the way, they did give chance. If you don't want to participate in all that's going to happen, you're allowed to get out. And some people went out. But things got desperate now. You got food shortages, and there were men shortages, and so they instituted polygamy, and they decided everybody's going to have everything in common. They're going to fight to the death in the setting up of Christ's kingdom. And somebody, somewhere along the line, betrayed the cause and allowed the surrounding siege army to come in to the city, and the wholesale slaughter of the rest of the Anabaptists began. And they got Rothman and two of the other leaders, killed them, tortured them, and put them in those cages and put them up high in St. Lambert's Church to show this is what happens if you're an Anabaptist. You can't tolerate these people. So that's the story there. All right. Now I'll take that cordless mic as I go down below here. I'm sorry. I have to take care of this properly. I decided this evening I'm going to give you something for free. While this story, our stories with the Dutch Anabaptists, while this is going on in Holland, see, this side is the Dutch side. Okay, this is the Swiss Brethren side. That's the side where most of us are from. Okay, you notice that the Swiss was born first, and 10 years later, Anabaptism was born in Holland. And Anabaptism was born in Holland partly with the story that I just gave you. And Menno Simons became a part of this movement as a result of Munster, that terrible story I just gave. And it wasn't only that Munster that some of this violence took place. Menno's own brother, Peter, also joined this movement. And Menno was already into reading the scriptures, and he thought, this is terrible. This is not what the scriptures teach. But here I am sitting, a fat priest, playing cards and drinking every day, and I know better, and I'm doing nothing about it. And finally, it was so impacting on his soul, he decided he's just going to join these people. And he never, his constant cry was against what these Munsterites did. And even though the authorities hunted him, he tried to persuade them, no, we are not those Munster people. We don't believe in that. But it was too late. The story had already happened. And Menno had a price put on his head. If anybody would have gotten him and handed him in, they'd have gotten a bounty. But nobody ever did. He died a peaceful death. Okay, so that's over on this side. And you notice that the Swiss and the Dutch experienced persecution at the same time. But these people had their persecution ending earlier. And the last martyr these people had, I think, was 1574. And soon after that, they began to enter into the golden age of Holland. I talked about that last night. Okay, at the same time this is happening over here, in our story, the Amish separation took place in the Swiss-German ranks. Okay, so I'm going to be going down this side, but I wanted to talk about this a little bit. I mentioned last night, who of you here, since you have an Amish background, came in the first migration, and who came in the second migration? So I would just like to just share for free the reasons for the first Swiss-German migration. If you have ancestry in eastern Pennsylvania among that version of Amish in Lancaster County, that migration took place from 1707 to 1760. And here are the reasons. In Switzerland, and by this time in the Palatinate, which is north of Switzerland, there was war. And the Swiss brethren were invited to the Palatinate because the area was just simply emptied of people as a result of the 30 Years' War. One army would go through, kill people, kill cows, kill chickens, devastate the land. And another army would come back through, chasing people, killing more cows, more chickens, and more people. And another one would come through. And so finally, the land was just empty. Weeds were growing up, farms were falling into disrepair, and the Swiss brethren in Switzerland were laboring under persecution, and the lords up in the Palatinate said, you know what? Why don't we get those people up here? We really don't like them, but at least they would keep the land from going to weeds. And so they invited them up, tolerated them,
said you may not meet in groups of more than 20, and you may not evangelize, just exist here. Okay, so that's not real comfortable. It was tough in the Palatinate. And these are some of the things that pushed them out of the Palatinate eventually to America. War, we talked about that. Heavy taxation, and these people in the Palatinate could hardly survive because of heavy taxes and all that was against them. And then one year, in 1708, there was an extraordinarily severe winter where even some of the fruit trees died. And I just told you that there was some of these religious quarrels about what had happened with the Amish separation. By the way, it's no longer an Amish division. It's not proper to talk about an Amish division anymore. How many of you have Unserlite? The book Unserlite. Well, at least some of you do. Do you know that is a very significant book? My people always told that story, and we always called it the Amish division. But you can't say it anymore. Because Unserlite is the very first time that an Amish person wrote the story. You know, everybody tells a story from their own perspective, right? So my people always told the story, and we told it from our point of view, and the Amish were the bad guys. Okay, so now an Amishman wrote the story. And some things have come out that prove that the Amish aren't as bad as what we thought, and maybe some Mennonites were somewhat bad too. Okay? So if you want to read the complete story, read chapter 2 in that book. And in those 85 pages, the author Leroy Beachy realized this is going to go under the microscope, and I think he has 565 footnotes in that chapter alone. And lo and behold, it did go under the microscope. And the professional historians read it line by line to catch anything, and they caught a few minor things, but the story basically stands. And forever now, I'm trying to get it out of my head never to call it Amish division. It's just the Amish were first-generation people, and they were disappointed in my people. We were already into Nicodemism. Nicodemism is, okay, we said, look, let them baptize these babies. Just putting a little bit of water on them isn't going to happen to make them baptized at all. And so it was a way to escape persecution. And when the first generation Christians saw that, they said, that's not integrity. We're not behaving properly. And then we said we had adhered to the Dortric Confession, but we weren't adhering to the Dortric Confession. Talked about that some last night. And so there was this controversy here. And so, long and story short, is it was just in the best interest of everybody, it was understood, to just part ways. And later on, Jacob Ammon felt so bad about that, he excommunicated himself in an effort to reconcile, but the thing was too far apart, and it was never come back together again. If you want to read the whole story, read Letters of the Amish Division. And Ole Ammon, who was a brother to Jacob Ammon, actually has one of the very best pieces that I know of on how to make churches work. And it was not, he must have learned some tremendous things over this thing, because he really teaches congregational government and how to make it work. We may talk about that over here someday. All right. Not only was this a religious issue, but you know, there are such things as young people. And young people are adventurous. And some people just wanted a place where you can actually own property and you don't have all this tax stuff hanging over you. You don't have all these other restrictions. And about that time, William Penn came. And he began to come to our people in the Palatinate and to preach among us. And some of us became Quakers. And he also said that I got all this land over there in Pennsylvania from the King of England, and I'm inviting you. You're a persecuted people just like us Quakers. Why don't you come over there? I got some good land for you over there. And some of us went. Hans Herr and his group were some of the first people who went, and lo and behold, it was even better than what Penn said it was. And once that story got out, they wrote letters back home and saying, it's really good over here. We don't have all this war. We don't have all this tax. All we have is beautiful land and some peaceful Indians. Come on over. And beyond that, the British government actually helped them get here, made it easier for them to get here. And so we came, 4,500 of us, and then the French and Indian War came. And you can't travel while war is going on. So it stopped. I think there were 4,000 Swiss brethren, non-Amish, and 500 Amish that came that first shot. Okay? And then after the, in the years in between, the 60-year period in between, see, they ended in 1760, and the second migration begins in 1820. In that 60-year period, some of our people decided that they have to leave the Palatinate. So they went and joined the Dutch-Russian people up in the Vistula area. They didn't come to America. And they have been basically become lost to us, and they have become a part of that story. Now, those of you who have ancestors who came to Ohio, you see, the frontier had moved from Pennsylvania to Ohio in that 60-year period. So the land was already too expensive in Lancaster, in Pennsylvania, and even in western Pennsylvania, but Ohio was open, and Indiana. It seems like Anabaptists, as soon as the frontier was calmed down, the Indians were out sufficiently, Amish and Mennonites moved in right behind. Okay, so these people came to escape militarism that was associated with the Napoleonic Wars. They wanted to maintain their non-resistance. And there was still economic distress over there, and there was political unrest there, but there was economic opportunity in the Midwest. Now, there's a myth we have. We say that we came from Europe because of persecution. That's only half the truth. Yes, there was a push out of Europe, but there was an economic pull to America. So we came for two reasons, not just one. Okay, and you also see here the personal letters that were going back and forth to family members and the systematic advertisement by ship companies. Ship companies could make money on getting us over here. And so we came. And that's the end of what I'm going to talk to you about, our part of the story. We'll spend the rest of... Oh, no, there's one more thing I wanted to share with you. Once we got here, the land of the free and the opportunities we have actually was the sum of our undoing. This is a whole story in itself. All I'm going to do is just give you this little tidbit. The Swiss-German Mennonite financial prosperity in America resulted in a loss of separation from the world for us. We lost Gelassenheit. We lost voluntary commitment to the inward yield of the Spirit of God, and we lost the desire to yield to the discipline and order of brotherhood. And that was in stark contrast to the financial poverty in Europe. This points out God's dilemma. Now, this is also a part of the Dutch story, so I'm going to just mention this. God's dilemma is that since He is a loving God, He likes to bless people. And so, if He blesses me, well, for example, He just gives me this gift. God in heaven loves me, blesses me, and gives me this gift. The tendency of humankind is to look at the gift and to be so fixated on the gift that you forget the giver. So God's dilemma is He knows this is the way it is. When Jesus healed the 10 lepers, how many turned around and said thanks? 1 out of 10. Most people turn their eyes onto the gift and not the giver. So what God could say, well, I'm not going to bless these people because all it does is turn them away from me. I'm just going to keep them poor and dependent upon me. But that's contrary to the way God wants to do. You see what I mean? This is God's dilemma. Well, it has happened to both the Swiss-German people and also the Dutch Mennonite people. I shared this with you last night. Anyone who contemplates history cannot help but notice how the gift of blessed forgetfulness is given to virtually every generation in the unrolling years of history. This gift makes it possible for a given age, in the midst of its blithe optimism, to repeat the fatal mistakes of a previous generation with hardly a pang of remorse or fear. It's too true. I'm embarrassed. And I say, why do we keep repeating the mistakes of previous generations again and again and again? I don't know. Last night, I ended with the reason why the Dutch Mennonites declined in numbers and spirituality just as rapidly as they grew. And so this evening, I would like to pick up from there. As I said, they moved east in their persecution. They came to the land of the Vistula. That looks better. This is Danzig. This is the Baltic Sea. This is Poland. And this is the Vistula River. And this is the Delta area. Okay, and every one of those places is a Mennonite congregation. Well, the Mennonites were skilled at creating polderland with the aid of windmills. And the windmill is the icon for these Dutch-Russian Mennonites. And so that windmill skill got applied to this area, and they created a lot of new land that was marshy before. Good farmland out of previous land. But they were only tolerated as subjects here. There's a difference between citizens and subjects. A subject owes his loyalty to a king, and he has to do what the king says. A citizen, like we are in this country, we're allowed to vote. Subjects can't vote. Okay, so that was something new for our people. When we came to America, and in Pennsylvania, we could vote? What? That was new and strange, because we were so used to being subjects. Well, all these people were still subjects. But they were so valuable in creating new land that the government soon realized that they can't lose these people. But at the same time, they said they cannot purchase any new land or even subdivide what they had. So they were boxed in. And they were not allowed to evangelize or even accept half Mennonites into congregations. Now, this is by formal agreement. It was not quite the same as what happened over in the Palatinate. In spite of all this, they became wealthy and they became the envy of the local people. The governments want men and money. Now, they could not get these men for their military purposes, but they could get their money by taxing them. And so that's what they did. They got a lot of money from them by taxes. Okay, in this land, they lost their Holland Dutch, and they learned the language of the people of this land, which is called Plattdeutsch. And they have kept this new Plattdeutsch to this day. It's almost like a part of them. It's like, this is one of the last things they lose, Plattdeutsch. And while they're in this land, they kept their distinctive Flemish, Friesian, peculiarities and distinctives. And I'm just going to read now. If people were of a Flemish background, and if you recognize these names, it might indicate where you came from. The most common names of the Flemish were Klassen, Dick, Enns, Epp, Harder, Neufeld, Penner, Regier, Reimer, von Riesen, Thiessen, Warkenton, Wiens, and Wolke. Now the Friesens, who were the counterpart, had these common names: Albrecht, Allert, Bestwater, Dahl, Dirksen, Friesen, Froes, Funk, Grunau, Harms, Jansen, Meckelberger, Martens, Nickel, Pauls, Quap, Quiring, and Unger. And if they lived down the river further, which is more high land, You had other names such as Adrian, Balzer, Bartel, Ewert, Franz, Gors, Copper, Kluwer, Kerber, Schroeder, Stoba, or Staba, Unrau, and Voth. And if you have these names, you're of Polish origin. I can't even pronounce some of these. But one of them I can pronounce, Szczepanski. Okay. So that's just a human interest item. But these people, regardless of their Friesian or Flemish, they always took care of their own needy people. And they would never allow any of their people to become a public charge. They took care of their aged people. They took care of their homeless children. They operated their own hospitals. Nothing depended on the government. These people were not even permitted to have public funerals. And so they had a way of having a funeral without making it public. These people were not a literary people. As I said last evening, the Flemish preachers remained seated on a raised chair with no pulpit, no notes, no gestures, and they preached in the Dutch language for a long time. But by 1774, these people were at their bursting point. But there's no new land available, and America was not even considered. Some of these people, when they heard about America, couldn't imagine anybody wanting to go to America, because that's where the lawless people were. And if you had a revolver and you were willing to have a bunch of revolvers in your hips, you could go. But no non-resistant person would want to go to America. So in the midst of this pressure, Catherine the Great showed up, her self-oppression. Now, the reason she showed up is, oh, by the way, I think I showed just last night, too. These are the places where there were Mennonite settlements along the Vistula. The reason, yes.
Let's see if you agree with what I would like to clarify.
Okay.
Am I right that the Flems and the Flemish and the Friesians both spoke Dutch, but the Flemish sector is basically what's now northern Belgium?
Yes, the Flanders, yes.
That's the upper
column. Yes. Yes, that is very true. Thank you for that. That's exactly right. Today. Okay. Yeah. But probably once they live together in the same places right here, they're probably their Plattdeutsch was probably pretty well the same because they lived in the same geographical area here. Thank you for that. Okay, here is why Catherine the Great wanted them. She had been fighting a war over here with the Turks in this area, and she won the war. Well, when you win a war, certain people lose, and they have to move out. And here's the people who were the natives. These are somewhat similar to American Indians in our American history, the Nogai, Tatars. Okay? So when the Mennonites came into the land, these are the people that they encountered, the locals. These were not the former enemies. These people were kind of caught in the middle of the war. The enemies are out. These people are still in. And these people are thieves. And so when Catherine the Great wanted Mennonites to fill up this land, it's not that there was nobody there. These people were there. But they were like Indians. They weren't productive people. And she wanted productive people. And as I showed you, this is her picture. And I'm going to talk to you about some of the things that she said to these people. When she offered what I'm going to share with you next, these people were already at their bursting point, and within 50 years, half of this group of people in the Vistula area headed for Russia. Okay, now here is what she offered these people. This is incredible. This was her inducement to get these people over there. She gave them these guarantees. Number one, absolute freedom of religion. And by the way, the Mennonites pushed her on some of this. It was not just her volunteering this. It's like a bartering. They agreed on this. Okay, absolute freedom of religion. 70 hectares of free land for everybody. Number three, freedom to engage in business. Number four, freedom to brew beer and distill brandy. Number five, a prohibition against non-Mennonite cafes and inns operating on Mennonite land. Number six, a prohibition against selling brandy without their permission. Seven, 10 years of exemption from taxes. Eight, subsidy to cover travel costs to get there. Nine, the delivery of a supply of lumber for building houses. Number 10, a loan of 500 rubles for families that needed starting capital. 11, exemption from military service. And number 12, from payment of compensation, maintenance of roads and bridges, and other forms of servitude. And the Mennonite says, we'll come if you give us this. And she said, yes, I will do that. I promise. Now, the Mennonites received more than any other group. And I suppose that one of the reasons they got this is because Catherine herself was from Prussia. And she knew she was not bargaining with people who were not going to deliver on their end. She knew what she was bargaining for. And so I think that's why she made all these concessions. And I think she knew that these people would make the land fruitful and would serve as an example to other immigrant groups. And these Mennonites were only a small part of the people who came from Germany over there. There were Catholic people who came, there were Lutheran people who came, and there were Mennonite people who came. And she got her wish. The land filled up and was fruitful. This source says this lady would be proven right in the end. Russia was a land of unprecedented possibilities, but as would become apparent later, also a land of unprecedented grief. That's right. Exactly. In fact, I should show you. Once they got there, you might recognize some of these places. This is the Black Sea. This is the Crimean Peninsula. And when they first got here, there's Kortytsa, the first settlement. And by the way, when these people started coming, when they actually got down here, the local officials said, we're sorry, but the land we told you could come to isn't available. It's too close to the war front. And so they had to settle on undesirable land. And some of the new settlers were so upset that they weren't given their promises, they wouldn't even unpack their wagons. They're waiting for her to somehow give them the permission to go on where they were supposed to. But it didn't happen. And by the way, some of the lumber for the wood, the houses, it never got there. Thieves stole it before it ever got there, but they never made up for it. Okay, that was Kortytsa in 1788, and over here is Malashna in 1803. And Malashna was off to a much better start because the people who came were wealthy. Okay, I'm getting ahead of myself. Better stop right there. Okay, the people who stayed back in Prussia, the landowners, the wealthy, spent the next 100 years losing their non-resistance a little at a time. And I think I told you last night, if you want to read the detailed story of that, right there it is. I had the privilege of meeting this man, Mark Jansen. I was in a meeting in Goshen one day, and there's a man across the table, and I was asked what his name is. He said, Mark Jansen. I said, did you write this book? Yeah. So, in 1788, 228 Flemish families started for Russia. But there were no preachers to be found among them. The landowners were not allowed to leave. It's only the people who didn't own anything. And the preachers were the part of the landowning class. That meant there's 228 families coming with basically no leadership. Now, how do you think that's going to work? There's no baptisms, no marriages, and no communion. There's a whole story there. By 1824, once they started, they kept coming. And by 1824, which is even way past the time of Malashna, there were already 400 families in 18 villages over here at Cortiza, the old colony. Okay, so this movement started in 1788. In 12 years, Catherine died. But they had the agreement forever. But back in Prussia, there was continuing restrictions, and so there were continuing migrations out of Prussia to Russia. And so in 1803, a new destination of Malashna was started, and this time 162 families left. But this group had well-to-do farmers. But the Prussian government was smart. These people had to pay 10% on their property just to have the permission to leave Prussia. So not only did they tax them while they're there, they taxed them as they left. By 1820, there were 600 families. And by 1846, they were 10,000 people in 46 villages. And by 1870, the population of Mennonites stood at 45,000 in these areas. And by this time, we have all these other little colonies, villages springing up. This gives you a little idea where some of them were. You're probably familiar with Odessa. This is the Black Sea. This is Crimea. Here is Cortiza, the first settlement. Here is Malashna. This is Cortiza's first daughter colony, Bergthal. And this little colony right here, Fürstenland, becomes important in subsequent history because if you've ever heard of old colony Mennonites, this is where they came from, Fürstenland. Now, old colony Mennonites has nothing to do with old order. Like we talk about old order Amish or old order Mennonites. Not true of these people. This old colony is where they get their name. The first colony, old colony, Cortiza. Okay, you also notice right here, there's Hutterthal, a man we're going to shortly get to by the name of Johann Cornes, found these people up here someplace further away, and they were in desperate situation. He says, well, come on over, we'll help you. And so they did. And all the Hutterites that were in Russia came over here and settled right close to Malashna. And Cornes was true to his word, helped these people get established. They were so poor and desperate, they weren't even living in community by that time. But once they got here, some of them went into Bruderhof's. And then later on, if I get to it, every single one of those people went to America. Many of these people went to America. Most of these people went to America and Canada. But these are their main settlements in this area. One of the settlements is down here. Okay, when these people first got here, and probably in these daughter colonies, they had to stay. They had to deal with these Nogai, these Tatars, these Indian-like people, like our American Indians with their thievery. But they finally related to them, and when Johann Cornes died, some of these people came to his funeral even. Now, I would like to just pause here and talk to you about this man, Johann Cornes. As far as I know, there's no photograph of this man. That's a picture, a painting or something. This is an incredible story. I don't know if I've ever read anything quite like this. But this man was born near Danzig in Prussia, and he came along with his family to the Malashna colony in the second migration. They got a farm of 175 acres, and his father was a community's doctor. But this guy was a self-taught young man who worked at a variety of jobs, but he was especially diligent and intelligent and responsible. He got married, got his own corn, his own farm, and quickly became a successful farmer. And whatever he did seemed to prosper. By 1830, by the time he is 41 years old, he established an experimental farming station where he raised purebred horses, cattle, and sheep. He imported the best animals from all over Europe, including Merino sheep from Spain. And by 1847, he owned 500 horses, 8,000 sheep, 200 head of cattle. He cultivated 25,000 acres of land and planted tree saplings, which he sold to other Mennonites. During his lifetime, he encouraged 47 villages to plant 5 million trees, many of them fruit trees. And so when these people came in, it was a treeless steppe. Suddenly, there are trees all over the land, many of them fruit trees. And so forests began to take shape. And he introduced the potato to Russia. And he promoted irrigation and crop rotation. Now, the Russian government was watching all these people. And when he was only 28 years old, the government said, you are so good at what you're doing. We're going to make you the lifelong chair of the Agricultural Society, which is a committee with authority to regulate farming in all the German settlements, not just Mennonite, but Lutheran and Catholic as well. Well, since Cornies got appointed to this post by the government and not by the church, he had almost unlimited power. He had more power than the church leaders. One Russian Mennonite historian calls Cornies an enlightened despot, meaning that he was a dictator who ruled for the benefit of his subjects. And that's just about the way it was. But not all Mennonites appreciated this man. Some ministers resented his influence. They believe that he secularized Mennonite life by promoting economic growth at the expense of the church's concerns. Some conservative Mennonites objected to Cornies working so closely with non-Mennonites and non-Christians such as the No Guy, these Indians, we say. Not only did he work with the No Guy, he also worked with Jews and helped the Jews. When the conservative religious leaders opposed him, he used his authority to threaten them with exile. He says, if you don't listen to me, I'm putting you into exile. Whew. Now, I'd like to read, this is kind of a humorous story. It says, not everyone liked Johann Cornies, and some people could be creative in their criticism. From one village came persistent reports that trees planted according to the instruction of Cornies Agricultural Society had all died. Well, this was surprising because soil was good, the saplings were the best quality, and the instructions for planting and watering were detailed. And so the Agricultural Society sent inspectors out to investigate. And when the village mayor led them into the garden, the inspector saw that the mayor and his villages had played a joke on Cornies and the society. They had planted the trees with their branches in the ground and their roots in the air. The inspectors were angry that their village had made fools of the Agricultural Society. They rushed back to report what they had found. Cornies did not think that planting trees upside down was funny. The saplings cost money. Cornies declared that when the mayor was disrespectful of the society, he was actually disrespecting the czar, since the Agricultural Society had been chartered by the government. And so Cornies said that the mayor had to appear before the church to answer for his misdeed. The church then excommunicated the mayor and ordered him to be shunned. Members of the mayor's congregation even beat him physically as a punishment.
Wow.
Okay, we're going to have to end this here shortly. Well, when they took up this work with the government, they actually created a Mennonite commonwealth in Russia, and they reverted to the church-state model that their ancestors had paid a high price to escape. Remember, they had no Schleierheim confession. As I said last night, they made their own laws and enforced them, even beating their own people. They had little contact with their native Russian neighbors who lived in the surrounding villages, but they related to them by using them as servants. They did not learn the Russian language, and they did not allow native Russians to either go to their schools or come to their churches. Sometimes the Mennonites abused their native workers. They simply lived in isolation from the Russian society. On top of that, their church life was poor. You needed to be a church member in order to own land and be able to vote. So therefore, church membership did not result from an encounter with Christ. Church leaders found it difficult to carry out church discipline, and drunkenness was a real problem. Remember what the privilege said? We're allowed to make all of our own brandy, and we're allowed to regulate the selling of it. They didn't say anything about maintaining discipline against it. And drinking to this day remains a problem to these people. Okay, so the result of all this was wealth, and things were just not good. And early on, there was a revival in 1814 with Klaus Reimer. It was called Kleine Gemeinde, and that's a story. And then later on, things had continued to go downhill. The Kleine Gemeinde kind of lived. They were the little church. They were the small group of people in the midst of all these other Mennonites. And all these Mennonites resented these people. They basically looked down their noses at these people. And these people never got very big. But things got so bad with a large group of people that they had a second renewal movement in 1860, and that's where the Mennonite Brethren were born. And by that time, there was a real conflict. The Mennonite Brethren formed out of this big group, and it turned out to be a real sizable group compared to this little Kleine Gemeinde. And there was real opposition and sinful behavior between the two groups. Okay, I don't have time to go into that. And just after that, while the bad feelings were still going on over this division, in 1881, the Russian government says, okay, this privilege we gave you, Mennonites, is going to end. In 1881, they said this, and they said, within 10 years, you got to be Russianized. You got to start teaching Russian in your schools. You're going to have to start doing things the Russian way. Forget your German way. And that really shook things up. And this man right here, Cornelius Jansen, he was a grain broker in Berdyansk. He was a person who introduced binders to Russia so you could produce and be more efficient with farming grain. And then, of course, he was a broker, and he would send us to other countries. But he had bumped into some Quakers, and he had learned English. And if you want the rest of the story, you notice over on the table where we're having our meetings, the Anabaptist Voice has this man's story. This man is an unsung hero. I don't know why we've forgotten about this man. There's a long story here that would be delightful to tell, but you can just read it for yourself. When the government found that this man was actually in contact with John F. Funk in Elkhart, right here, our kind of Mennonite, a Swiss German Mennonite, and was making plans as to how his people could get out of Russia, one day the government showed up and said, you got 10 days to leave this country and never to return. Quite a blow. He negotiated with them, and I think he got 2 months to get everything out. But he left, never returned. Believe it or not, they said at the time, you are going with us right now to the photographer. And that's the picture they took of him. And this is to be posted at conspicuous places. This man is to be known to the people. He is to get out and never return. It's like a most wanted man picture. That was the picture right there.
That was 1873?
When he came over, it was, yes, I think it was 1873. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Whenever and this is a long story. Maybe I can tell you this some other night. But whenever they wanted to come over, they sent emissaries over, and they checked out Canada, and Canada was willing to give them free land. United States said, no, we can't. They're going to sell you railroad land. And of all the places, oh, by the way, I should tell you, Canada bid on these people. United States was bidding on these people. They both wanted them. These people offered them free land. These people offered railroad land. And so when they came over and did their investigating, what became, we know today as Old Colony people, came to this area, the West Reserve, and some Bergthalers and Klein and Komeindy came to this area until they had one winter there, and they said, this is too cold. So 30 families moved down to Nebraska. But and 8,000 people ended up here. 10,000 people got down here. The Secretary of Interior of Minnesota really wanted these people, but he could only convince 25 families to come to Minnesota. Some of them settled in Nebraska. Cornelius Jansen himself settled right over here. See Jansen? That one, Jansen, is named for his son, Peter. He lived at Beatrice, Nebraska, over here. This was Cornelius Jansen's choice. He thought that's a great place to come. The Hutterites came to here, but most of them, by far the largest part of this emigration, came to your area right here, well, just east, northeast of you, Newton, McPherson, and Hillsboro. That's a whole story in itself. Maybe we'll tell you that. Okay, I want to conclude by talking to the children about something. How many of you children have ever read this story, The Forsaken Child? Nobody. Well, if you take a look at this picture, this actually happened in West Reserve, right up here, I think. This girl, she was a married woman, she was childless, walked out of her house one day and saw a baby in a pig pen with a sow nosing it, getting ready to eat this baby. And so this lady rescued this baby, and the boy grew up to be called the Hog Boy. And if you talk to certain Russian people, they know this story. The story is not that well written, but it is an unforgettable story. And so you might consider finding that. Thank you for your attention.